be lovely. I'm not going to say anything about medical encounters today, or probably not next week either. Possibly the week after, if I weaken. But I haven't thought that far ahead. The reading list that I've passed out for you lists the, in the first little segment on the front, the main things that I have relied upon and that I will be citing and referring specifically to in the lecture that I'm giving you today. And then there's a long list of journals that are practically whole issues or symposia or something like that that's appended onto the end that I don't make a specific reference to, but that I'm sure if you dip around in the journals, you'll find that they've influenced my thinking quite substantially. And I discovered that these two references that I've written up on the board are omitted from that kind of general background influence list, so I've put them on. There'd be, you know, fists full of other articles, and I discovered that they're almost all in those symposia special issue journals, so I haven't listed, you know, separately 11 to 20 articles by Epstein that keep cropping up in all the different journals and so on. I've only referred you to the special issues, which are in fact virtually books that have fed into my thinking on this matter. I've forgotten what it says I'm supposed to be talking about exactly today. Let's see. It says here, Assumptions in Sociology. Yeah, I have a rather more inflammatory title. I call this lecture Values and Science and Sexism in Sociology. And I'm going to talk about those two things because I think that they are conceptually related and it's necessary to say some things about values in science at the general level before one can go on to talk specifically about sexism in sociology. So let me lay my cards on the table for you. First of all, I think I need to say something about the whole idea of value freedom in science. I hope this isn't replaying an old record for too many of you, and I'll do it as quickly as I can. There was a notion around for a while, and it wasn't all that long ago, that people who call themselves scientists simply had to adhere to a set of procedures, technical procedures, that were usually referred to as the scientific method. Illuminated script, please. And that set of processes within which scientists were supposed to operate was a completely objective realm to which values were simply not relevant. And I think that one needs to, there have been a lot of attacks on this point of view, many of them very elaborate, complicated, abstract ones that have been done by philosophers of science in the last 20 or 30 years, I suppose, most energetically. But I want to deflate that idea in three fairly concrete ways. First of all, it seems to me that one has to acknowledge that science itself and its methods include a set of more or less explicit values. And the trick, of course, is that they were less explicit, and that was why it was possible to go along for such a long time with people getting away saying that science could be value-free. It seems to me that one of the obvious values of science is that it is better to know than not to know. Well, you might say, well, yeah, obviously. but it seems to me that that does constitute a statement of value, so that by its very nature, science has a value perspective. That is, that knowledge is a good thing and that it's better than not having knowledge. But further, I think scientific-minded people, if I can create such a category, would probably also go on to say that certain ways of knowing are better than other ways. for scientific purposes. That is, that empirical investigation, that the characteristic of repeatability, that falsifiability, open-mindedness, and so on, are all superior intellectual perspectives than alternatives that one might nominate. Now, I think probably I could say that those would be values that would be common to virtually any person who would ascribe to membership in the scientific community. And if one were to take subsets of the scientific community, you could get a much longer list of values that are actually part of the scientific endeavor and the scientific process. But I wanted to state it at its most general, non-refutable form to establish, I think, the basic point that science itself has a value perspective, if I can reify science a little bit. Secondly, and this is the argument that has been developed most notably, I suppose, by Kuhn in his book on Structure of Scientific Revolutions, is the notion that at any specific period in the development of a particular field of inquiry, particular perspectives will dominate the field, and they will be evaluated to be superior to, evaluated, notice that's values coming back in again to the scientific process, they will be evaluated to be superior to the ones that have been thrown out before. The Copernican Revolution, I suppose, being in a sense the archetype of that kind of throwing over of a previous theoretical outlook and a whole way of looking at reality, in inverted commas. So that at any time, a certain perspective will dominate what is considered proper or good, whatever it is, ology. And it seems to me that one could note that at the moment in sociology, I would say that quantification, that studies that involve a lot of quantification are considered better sociology than studies that don't. And those of us who tend to be a little uneasy about putting everything in terms of numbers tend to have a lot more to do to justify ourselves within the community, and we tend to be much more marginal people, which turns out to have its advantages, than people who are really good, solid, you know, maths and stats folks. And I don't mean to put that down. I simply mean to say that there is that that implicit evaluation now, and that one does a lot more backpedaling if one talks about things like, you know, ideas and you know, other somewhat less quantified kinds of phenomena. I think there's also been, in the fairly recent past, a kind of a growth of what I guess I would call anti-establishment sociology, so that now taking pot shots at fat cats is the done thing. Where maybe 15, 10 years ago, that wouldn't have been so much the done thing. So that you get a different evaluation of work that takes on a different social value point of view. And I don't think that that can be weeded out, nor from my own perspective should it be. And that leads, rather obviously, that little aside, to the third point, on the basis of which I think one has to reject the notion of value freedom in science, and that is that for any given researcher, there are going to be value components in what she or he studies, in what hypotheses we are inclined to entertain. That is, there are certain things that are personally motivating to certain people and not to others. And those very often have personal value components in them. And as I hinted a moment ago, for my money, that's as it should be. That doesn't worry me to recognize that. It seems to me that is of necessity the way we are as human animals, and the danger only occurs when we deny the fact that those things are relevant to our research. So that you bet I was interested in studying doctors out of responses to personal feelings about what had happened to me and to people that I knew. And the thing that would worry me would be if I didn't acknowledge that and then be sure to ride myself a bit harder when things were turning out the way I expected them to. Okay. All this doesn't mean, then, that science is not different from any other kind of inquiry, but rather that the objectivity that we seek when we try to work as scientists is not value freedom, but freedom from bias. And I'd like to read you a few quotes from a sort of a culture hero of mine, Abram Kaplan, who's listed on that reading list. Kaplan has a lot of very pithy things to say about bias. What constitutes bias is that the will to believe is motivated by interests external to the context of inquiry itself. I find it useful to distinguish between the scientist's motives and his, this is after all 1964, his purposes. Motives concern the relation between the scientific activity and the whole stream of conduct of which it is a part. Purposes relate the activities of inquiry to the particular scientific problem which they are intended to solve. Thus, a scientist's motives may include the love of country or of money or of glory. His purposes must be specified in terms of the particularities of the problem in which he is engaged, to show that a given phenomenon is subject to certain laws, or that an explanation can be extended to a certain other class of cases, or the like. Various purposes may serve any motive, and various motives may be involved in the decision to fulfill any particular purposes. Bias might be defined as the intrusion of motives, which are extra-scientific, on the fulfillment of scientific purposes. And then he goes on to say, freedom from bias means having an open mind, not an empty one. At the heart of every bias is a prejudice, that is to say, a prejudgment, a conclusion arrived at prior to the evidence and maintained independently of the evidence. What serves as evidence is the result of a process of interpretation. Facts do not speak for themselves. Nevertheless, the facts must be given a hearing, or the scientific point to the process of interpretation is lost. And then he gives this rather neat example. Describe to someone what appears to be the favorable outcome of an experiment on telepathy. He will say that the proportion of successes or the number of cases was too small to be significant. Ask him to suppose that 10 times as many cases were taken and that the results were 10 times as favorable. He will then suggest that trickery was involved. Continue with the supposition that this is ruled out by the character and integrity of the subjects as well as the investigators, and he will postulate responses to unconscious cues. And if you say, suppose the conditions of the experiment preclude this effect, the subjects being in widely separated rooms, and so on, he will propound some other possible explanation. But at some point, what he should say is, if the inquiry and its results were as you hypothetically describe them to be, I would believe in telepathy. The prejudice is betrayed in the determination to adhere to a certain belief no matter what evidence is brought forward. It is this determination or the approximation of it, and not merely having an interest in one conclusion or another, which constitutes bias. Values make for bias not when they dictate problems, but when they prejudge solutions. Well, it's a little bit long, but I think it's really important to those of us who are frank about our interests, because I think there's a tendency to reject out of hand people who acknowledge the fact that they have interests in certain kinds of inquiry. I buy that. Right. Well, having dispensed with the idea that there is such a thing as value freedom in science, I now want to give a few moments of attention to the concept of sexism. I think this as well may be old news, but perhaps the sociological perspective on sexism may have a slightly fresh angle. And so I'm going to offer that. I think that it would be easy to spend the rest of the hour in elaborating the documentation that is now available about discrimination against women in all areas of scientific work, and this can certainly be done within sociology too, and some of the articles on that reading list that I've given you refer to that. This Epstein one is perhaps a good starting point if you're interested in that. The whole business of hiring, promotion, and tenure and so on is well documented to have been subject to sex discrimination, and I don't propose to talk about that today. What I want to look at is perhaps the broader question of the whole intellectual concept of sexism. And somebody's filched my Jesse Bernard quote. There's a reference on your list to an article by Jesse Bernard where she elaborates the concept of sexism within sociology. And what she argues is that sexism is not, from the sociological point of view, necessarily the conscious intended prejudice of any individual against women or women's work or women's values, but rather that sexism is the unconscious, taken for granted set of perspectives that result in certain kinds of social arrangements that disadvantage and devalue women and their activities. So that it's not necessary to posit motivated conscious intention. And she specifically elaborates the analogy between sexism and racism and points out that the concept of racism had to be introduced into sociology in order to account for the phenomenon that well-meaning people, people with the very best interests of blacks at heart, continued to be able to enact discriminatory policies and practices because of the fact that the set of perspectives within which they were working precluded all the sorts of things that black scholars in the disciplines would have brought to bear in the first place. So that it wasn't because the sociologists were very careful to say that they were not hiring blacks, not because they were innately inferior or anything like that, but simply because they didn't meet the educational and intellectual standards that were required. And the same sorts of arguments have obviously been used within sociology in order to account for the treatment of women within the discipline. To say that, you know, of course, you know, it's not that women are innately inferior, it's not that I am prejudiced against them, or that I personally discriminate, but a good woman is so hard to find, you know, in short form. So it's that taken for granted, hidden in sociologists' language, latent quality about sexism that in a way makes it all the more potent than overt self-aware prejudice would be. And I think that that provides the context within which to make the note that sexism is therefore not necessarily simply the province of men, and that just as some black people internalize the value judgments and orientations of white society and regard their own failure to conform to the expectations of whites as somehow evidence of inferiority, the same thing can be said about women and their responses to their systems. So that the usual reply, well, but you know, women are, you know, the most ardent proponents of some discriminatory or hierarchical practices, is not in any way a dismantling of the concept of sexism that stands. Okay, what with that kind of background, what I want to do for the remainder of the hour is to talk about the concept of sexism within sociology and to consider sexism as a form of bias, which has had, in my opinion, profound social and intellectual impact on the discipline, and insofar as the discipline has had any impact on the wider society, potentially on the wider society too. So I want to say a few things about sexism in and scholarship generally, and here I'm skating very quickly over some very broad material. The 19th century view of gender as being the same thing as physiological sex fitted into a situation in which very few women attained any higher education at all. The religious and moral justifications and the ideologies that supported this situation were interwoven with views about the nature of men and women and of the proper relation between the sexes. And the exclusion of women from higher education and the various medical and economic and legal definitions of women and their roles came from men, were reinforced by men, and reinforced the secondary and in many instances almost childlike status for women during this period. This is when you get the ideas propounded by medical doctors of the period that if women were to achieve higher education, their ovaries would shrivel and their uteruses wouldn't work anymore, which I like to think of as a sort of a hydraulic model. You know that if any of the energies are going up here, the pelvis will just sort of wilt and it will cease to perform its most important function. There wasn't a whole lot of sociology done in this period, although you did get the emergence of evolutionary theories of the family during the 19th century, which have become integrated into sociology more latterly. I'm sure that Sue will be giving you a lot more about the emergence of feminism generally, but it seems to me that one of the interesting characteristics of the suffragist movement was that one of the strategies that was used, by no means the only one, but one of the very prominent ones, was to, in fact, play upon the beliefs about the differences between men and women, rather than to try to override those differences. So that rather than appeal for votes, for women to be granted the right to vote on the basis of equality between men and women, in some instances, the appeal was made on the basis of the fact that women were morally superior, that granting of the right to vote to women would regard in moral uplift, that society would be improved by this because of women's aversion to war and violence and conflict and drink and so on. So that this would have a purifying effect on society because of those innate natural differences between men and women. That particular strategy, in a sense, would have served to reinforce rather than to cross-cut the very profoundly held ideological views on the differences between men and women. I do hasten to add that was only one strategy, one strand, and I wouldn't want to oversimplify. Then in sociology, in, say the first half even of the 20th century, you got a period that I think has been described by somebody that I can't now recall as "don't worry about the women." After a brief upsurge in higher education for women, you got a decline in the proportion of higher degrees being awarded to women in the United States, reaching its low point in the 1950s, which in the United States, of course, was the peak of the feminine mystique period and the retreat of women from the public arena during the post-war period. I understand that that dichotomy is not as clear-cut in Australia, so that the, although socially that difference probably was not reflected in the same way in Australian society that perhaps it was in the United States. Given the patterns in the US and the fact that so much scholarship was being imported to Australia during that period, I would say that in higher education the same kind of thing would have been, or the influence of that pattern would have been reflected in the literature that was being imported into Australia, let me put it that way. That is, the written stuff that would have been coming would have reflected this sort of eclipse of women in higher education. And then during the 60s and 70s, there was, I think, quite a radical change of consciousness. Some of the material on which people were working had been around for a long time, but the way it was interpreted and the way it was used really did change. Some people have called it a paradigm change. Whether it is that or not, I'm not sure, in part because I'm less sure what a paradigm is anymore. But something happened anyhow. And what happened seems to have had a good deal to do with the women's movement, among other things. I think in the United States, probably the movement for racial equality essentially cleared the way, and the women's movement kind of came in on the coattails and they softened up by the blacks. And then the anti-war movement further attuned people in the academy to their relationship with that big bad world outside and to the fact that their previous work had been very much establishment status quo oriented and that some things needed to be rethought. And then the feminist movement had its impact on the social sciences in this general context of things already having been dug up quite a bit. And the discipline in a certain amount of disarray as a result of several critiques that had already been brought to bear. And this article by Dorothy Smith that I've written up on the board, it has been quite neglected, which I think is a pity because it's one of the most carefully worked out and elaborated expressions of how the feminist critique can be brought to bear on sociology, what the intellectual consequences of that might be. Some of the characteristics of this change, paradigm or otherwise, are that there began to be investigation both of the intellectual discrimination that had characterized previous work within sociology, and from what I've heard Di Bell say this morning, anthropology as well, and also a reassessment of the adequacy of the earlier work that had been done. And out of this era, you got this whole proliferation of new journals, which have now been very much integrated into our everyday work in universities. One in social psychology called Sex Roles that you've probably already encountered. Signs, of course, Feminist Studies. There's a Journal of Women in Health, Refractory Girl from Australia. The Women's Studies Abstracts and so on, and now the Women's Sociological Bulletin being published out of Adelaide at the moment. You got caucuses, feminist caucuses and so on. Well, as far as the perception of sexism within sociology itself, I think one of the nicest summaries of this comes from Epstein. It's a different article from this one on the board. I think I've listed it on your list there. She sums it up in a rather pithy fashion. She says, sociology has given us an incomplete and probably distorted view of reality because of its systematic inattention to the place and participation of women in social life. To explore fully what the character of the field would have been without this flaw, one would have to rethink the work of social scientists and social philosophers on the entire scope of the human condition. Any view of reality is to some degree subject to the perspective of a particular group. The goal is always to strive for objectivity by cutting through one's cultural and chauvinistic blinders. But what has passed for scientific objectivity in sociology has often fallen far short of that standard. The failure of objectivity, which results from what may be called the male perspective, is only one of many, but it is an important one. Most descriptions of society have been recorded and analyzed by men and have centered on the world of male endeavors. Male sociologists have omitted women from their perspective in the same way humans usually ignore the animal world around them when they describe life. One of the ways in which this is manifested, I think, is in the choice of topics that sociologists have generally been engaged on. That is, the discipline as a whole has emphasized areas of interest to men and male worlds: power, work, careers, conflict. Those are the heavy topics, and they still are, I might add. If you want to get brownie points, those are the sorts of things that you want to research and publish on. Everybody keeps remarking to me how, gee, hasn't family sociology come a long way lately? And although there's a good deal of truth in that, part of where it's come a long way is up here in people's heads. Granted, there's some superior work being done, but all of the earlier stuff wasn't necessarily hopeless. But we're finally beginning, you know, there's been a real sort of dropping away of the scales from people's eyes. And well, gee, you know, maybe something important does go on inside households is the nature of the transformation. Only without that kind of self-aware change in many quarters, so that it's been very subtle and interesting sort of change. And Bernard complains, very little of sociology deals with the nature, structure, and functioning of the female world. Bernard again in the Four Revolutions article says, the topics that have preoccupied sociologists have been the topics that preoccupy men: power, work, climbing the occupational ladder, conflict, and sex, but not women, or women only as adjuncts to men. When women have been dealt with in this sociology of male society, it has been in a chapter or a footnote on the status of women, thrown in as an extra almost beside the point, rather than as an intrinsic component of a total society. Secondly, there's this problem of the choice of topics. What sociologists pick out to study in the first place. Secondly, and I think it's implicit in this quote that I just read you from Jesse Bernard, that even in what has been studied, there's been a tendency to omit women, or as she says, to relegate them to footnotes. That is, both women as subjects, or to give women an opportunity to explain their own experience, has simply not been a part of the sociological strategy. And I think that probably the one of the most striking examples of this is in a domain which is probably male sociology par excellence, namely stratification. The sociology of hierarchies, if you want to put it that way. For a very long time, stratification treated the unit of analysis as the family. That is, when you were going to identify the social status in the hierarchy, you identified the status of the family, not on the whole status of individuals. And one would think that that might mean that that meant the status of a group of people, and that therefore characteristics of all those relevant people would have been taken into account, but not so. The status of the family was determined on the basis of the characteristics of the male head of household breadwinner. And for generations in sociology, nobody ever queried that methodology. Clearly, that was how it was done. Everybody knew that. Whether one chose to use occupational prestige or some sort of conglomerate of income, education, occupation, whatever, it still was always the characteristic of the male head of household. Well, along came feminism and began to ask uncomfortable questions about that. The problem, of course, was how do you decide about the status of an unattached female? I mean, if you're using male status as the way of identifying everybody else, then a male without a family, that doesn't present any problems. You just proceed according to the usual patterns. But what are you going to do when you've got an unattached female for whom there is no husband or father to use as the basis of the assignment of status? Well, that's a bit of a problem, but you could, I suppose, use the same sorts of formulae that you use for the assignment of male status, and that was also done with the recognition that that created certain kinds of problems, because the prestige hierarchies that had been established for males' jobs didn't always work all that well in a highly segregated labor force. And so that if women didn't do men's work, what did we make of them? And that even if they did it mean the same thing? So obviously you begin to get a whole lot of questions that are just eroding the whole set of tacit assumptions on the basis of which this massive amount of research had been done. I don't know whether it's, more pages have been published about stratification than anything else in sociology, but I'd say it would be right up there in the top 10 if it's not the most the most voluminous, and certainly at this university it would be the most voluminous. That's the name of the game. I think the questions that are being asked are very profound questions. I'm not sure that the ways that people are going about answering them are necessarily the right ways, but that's a separate question. Well, anyway, that sort of critique about the assumptions that have existed within the discipline and how certain kinds of research endeavors have been carried out could be applied not only to stratification research, but to the study of deviance, to the study of large organizations, to medical sociology, to urban sociology, occupations and work, demography, you name it, you can do the same kind of critique about how basically unexamined assumptions about the nature of women and the nature of the relations between men and women and women's relevance to society has undermined the scientific objectivity of the work that has been done in sociology. And I refer you to those collections in the journals that are listed. I think perhaps a few specific quotes might be, or examples might be kind of fun at this stage, because this has all been faintly abstract. One of the main strategies, as I'm sure all of you are aware, of scientific work is in the generation of what's called an operational definition of something. That is, in this particular instance, a researcher named Wallen wanted to study intimacy. Now, you would think we're getting into things where women's orientations might have some relevance. Intimacy in couples. And, how are you going to know when you got intimacy is the question. Scientists have to be able to get something that's going to be reproducible, that the next person can come along and measure the same thing and presumably get the same results. But since nobody ever replicates anybody, that doesn't happen. In 1957, Wallen, who was no dope, I hasten to add, set out to investigate religiosity, marital satisfaction, and sexual gratification. And in this inquiry, he needed, of course, an operational definition of sexual gratification. And what was interesting was that he had different operational definitions for males and for females. For females, this was what he referred to as reported frequency of orgasm, and there were four categories. For males, the operational definition was extent of relief from sexual desire, and there were six categories here. I'm not quite sure how he decided, you know, which one would get which, but anyhow. Furthermore, he, in the process of doing this study, got information on the reports of agreement between husband and wife about the wife's frequency of orgasm. And there was only a 55% rate of agreement between husband and wife in the reports of the wife's frequency of orgasm. So he had problems with his operationalization there. Who was he going to believe? But what was interesting about this, I mean, you know, it just sort of piles thing upon thing here. He didn't have any check on the husband's reliability. That is, the wife was not asked to confirm or disconfirm the husband's extent of relief from sexual desire. I suppose on the assumption that only the person concerned would be competent to say how relieved of sexual desire they were. Well, going from bad to worse, then when he started collating his results, we find that the definition of high sexual gratification, now this is when you're going to do all your cross tabulations, right, and do sexual gratification by everything else. He defined women as being high on sexual gratification if they were in either of the two top categories, two of four. Whereas for men, anything other than complete relief, which was the top of six categories, was deemed not satisfactory. Okay? Right, well, you know, that one is fairly fraught. And rather than do 10 more, I'll leave you with the list of literature. You can go and do it yourself because it's lots of fun. When I brought up that whole thing about intimacy, I forgot to mention that the study that I can recall from the mists of the past, and I can't now remember where it was or who did it, was that the operational definition of intimacy in the study was premarital intercourse. If that's not a male definition of intimacy, I don't know what is. Okay. Well, the result of all this is, as Epstein has pointed out, a hell of a lot of ignorance, some of which is being rectified. And I think a deep but probably unconscious value perspective that continues to underlie an awful lot of what goes on in sociology. I can recall not all that long ago when there was a conversation going on at the tea table talking to some of my colleagues, and it was basically professional gossip about some antagonisms among sociologists, and one of them said, what we need is a sociology of hate. And I thought that's a pretty good idea. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, Arlie Hochschild has proposed some of the basics of a sociology of emotion. And everybody just went, I'm sure that I could not have disturbed or offended or whatever it was that I did them anymore, you know, if I had insulted their most, you know, deeply held personal values. It was obviously an absolutely absurd thing to say. A sociology of the emotion, imagine that. And then there was lots of tittering, and what could that possibly be relevant to? And you know, whoosh, it was gone, just like that. So much for the sociology of the emotion, aborted in its infancy. Okay, well, I've already pointed out that marriage and family studies enjoyed very low prestige until recently, and I think sociology of the family is still essentially fighting for its intellectual respectability, and the fact that the people who are involved in teaching and learning sociology of the family are mainly of the female persuasion is no accident, I think. And that's been the case for a long time. It's been suggested by Ehrlich in the Journal of Marriage and Family that I've listed on there that the so-called value-free social science is full of myths and folklore about the female which are presented as factual and which are used to justify the subordinate status of women. That article, I highly recommend that article by Ehrlich. She's got essentially a point-by-point documentation of the pervasive myths about females as passive, as less sexually motivated, as more moral, as biologically determined. And this was in, must have been the August 71 journal, 71, 73, which is it? Journal of Marriage and the Family, 71. Yeah. And you can get the same sort of critical review of the literature, for example, on marital power, which is in that same journal, one on sex role socialization, one on marital adjustment, and one on family therapy. And each of these critics has essentially taken a sub-area within sociology of the family and dissected it and enumerated the areas within which it has essentially failed to achieve its mandate as part of what is supposed to be science. Now, the assumption that seems to me to be pervasive at the moment is that, of course, what's going on now, all the rectification of these old bad ideas, is all in the interests of liberation and the improvement of everybody's life. And I'd like to close with a rather disturbing suggestion that's come out of an article by Alice Rossi, which appeared in Daedalus a couple of years ago. There's a lot that one could say about that article that I won't go into today because it's a very complicated and difficult piece. But one of the things that I think needs to be heard is her suggestion that the new family sociology and the new feminist sociology generally, but we're looking at the new family sociology particularly, is perhaps not really as pro-woman as we might have been inclined to think up until now. She makes two particular critiques of that. One in reference to the work that's being done on the relations between men and women, and particularly about sexual relations. And secondly, in regard to parent-child relationships. And I'll give you a couple of quotes from her as a kind of a roundup. She says, and you know, I think her own values are coming through here, but perhaps it's worth giving her a hearing. A close reading of the literature on contemporary sexual practices and on the attitudes of the young suggests that the model is a male pattern. Early initiation, sexual diversity, physical play through casual sex. In studies of adolescent attitudes toward sexuality, it has been found that adolescents are coming to regard sex as a good way to get acquainted, a means to develop rather than express couple intimacy. At the same time, extremely large gender differences still exist among the holders of such attitudes, with men 2 to 3 times more apt than women their own age to endorse the more casual attitude toward sexuality. The literature on co-marital sex shows that in 3 out of 4 cases, it is the husband who initiates the seeking of other sex partners. Participation tends to last about 6 months. The wives tend to be homemakers with neither jobs nor community involvements, and the couples are very careful to keep their sexual activities a secret from their children. Sexual liberation, then, seems to mean that increasing numbers of women are now following male initiatives in a more elaborate multi-partner sexual script. And then she goes on to talk about relations between parents and children and to talk about the rather more casual, less committed kind of parent-child and particularly mother-child relationships that appear to be characteristic of some of the counterculture child-rearing contexts. And then she summarizes that by saying, just as the sexual script, so the parenting script in the new family sociology seems to be modeled on what had been a male pattern of relating to children, in which men turn their fathering on and off to suit themselves or their appointments for business or sexual pleasure. The authors and dramatists of both the mating and parenting scripts in the new perspectives on the family are just as heavily male as the older schools have thought about the modern family, if not in the generic sense, then in the sense that parenting is viewed from a distance, as an appendage to or consequence of mating, rather than the focus of family systems and individual lives. It is not at all clear what the gains will be for either women or children in this version of human liberation. And on that pessimistic note, I will conclude.
I read an article recently which describes that article under the heading of the anti-feminist backlash.
Yes, I think there's a lot in the article that I would agree is very anti-feminist. I think she takes a very it's called a biosocial perspectives, and it's not biosocial, it's very, very much biological in a lot of what it says. She does seem to be, at least in this particular article, taking a very biological deterministic point of view, even though she claims otherwise. But I see those two arguments as being rather distinct from all of the biological stuff, and I feel as though one can, one can hear that critique without having to buy the biological determinism that she seems to be selling in the rest of the article. But, I'm not sure that I've really come to rest about that. But yes, I agree. I was absolutely horrified when I read that article. I thought, the founding mothers are abandoning us. What are we going to do when Alice Rossi talks like this? Yeah.
Thank you.